Chapter 25. Despite the aura of death in the air, Austin maintained an uncanny serenity. He had developed the ability to shift his brain into what could best be described as a mental overdrive. While his synapses continued to crackle, an inner voice slowed his thought processes, calmly taking in details fed to it by the senses and formulating a plan of action. He and Theri faced two possible fates. At a signal from their leader, the men pacing on both sides could carve them up with their hatchets. More likely, Austin judged, Scarface would do the job as he himself had promised. Neither option was particularly desirable, and Austin was working on a third, although it wouldn't have been apparent to their escorts. He glanced fearfully around him, giving the impression of being consumed with panic and confusion, while mentally he mapped out an escape route and calculated the odds. Theri squeezed his hand until his knuckles hurt. "What should we do, Kurt?" she said, with only the slightest tremor in her voice. The question gave Austin a sense of relief. It told him that, far from having given up hope, Theri was also looking for a way out of their predicament. Her determination suggested that she could call upon untapped reserves. She would need them, Austin thought. Keep walking. Just think of it as a stroll in the park. Theri glanced sideways at their silent escorts. Some stroll. Some park. I haven't had so much fun since our Copenhagen date. The spark of humor was a good sign. They took a few more steps. Austin murmured, "When I say mush, I want you to follow my lead." "Did you say mush?" "That's right. Stay with me. Climb up on my heels if you have to. No matter where I go, stay close." Theri nodded and they continued to walk at a snail's pace. Austin and Theri had advanced close enough to Scarface to see the hard eyes glittering like black diamonds under the low-cut bangs. The other's shadows seemed in no hurry, probably trying to draw out the terror as long as possible. In their black coveralls, the men looked like mourners at a wake. Austin saw them only as dangerous obstacles to be removed or eluded. The real focus of his attention lay off to the left. The red dog sled had been left unattended. The dogs sat or lay curled up on the grass, eyes half closed, mouths open in a canine grin. Austin took a deep breath. Timing would be everything. Another step closer to the end of their lives. Scarface anticipated their arrival. His hand dropped to the hilt of the bone knife in its scabbard. The cruel mouth widened in a smile, like someone licking his chops over a tender steak. He said something to his man in an unintelligible language. It was only a few words, probably a gloating remark, but it caught the attention of his men, who all looked in their leader's direction. Austin gripped Theri's hand. "Ready?" he whispered. She squeezed back. "Mush!" Austin sidestepped to his left, yanked Theri practically off her feet, and lunged toward a gap in the line of pickets. The guards saw them break out and tried to head them off, like defensive linebackers converging to stop a runner. They raced toward the closing gap. At the last moment, Austin changed direction. He shook off Theri's hand and, putting all the weight of his body behind his shoulder, smashed into the midsection of the guard to his left. The man let out a sound like a malfunctioning steam engine and doubled over. The other guard charged in, hatchet in hand. Using the bounce from his first encounter, Austin came out of his crouch and slammed into the man with his other shoulder. The impact lifted the other man off his feet. The hatchet went flying onto the grass. Theri was right behind him. A few more steps, and they were at the sled. The dogs noticed their approach and perked their ears up. Austin grabbed the sled's upright framework and held it tight. He didn't want the dog team to bolt off. Without being instructed, Theri rolled onto the steel mesh platform, then sat up, legs extended forward, hands gripping the uprights in front of her. Austin kicked off the brake. "Hike!" he snapped in a clear, commanding voice. The sled's regular driver probably used an Inuit command, but the team knew from his tone what Austin wanted. Mushers don't use the word mush to get dogs moving. The word is too soft. Austin was a man of the sea, but he wasn't above developing land-based skills. Dog sledding, unfortunately, wasn't among them. He had tried dog sled driving a few times as a diversion on ski trips, and after being thrown into snowdrifts a couple of times, he discovered that it looked easier than it was. The driver had to balance on runners that seemed as thin as knife blades while trying to control a pack of animals only a few generations removed from their wolf brethren. Sled dogs were deceivingly small, but welded together in a team, they produced an incredible explosion of power with their short legs. He knew, too, that a dog sled driver had to come across as the leader of the pack if the strong-willed dogs are to respond to his commands. The team was on its feet even before he shouted the command. The gang line connecting the dogs to the sled went taut and the wheel almost jerked out of his hands. Austin ran several steps, helping the sled along, then he jumped on board and let the dogs do all the work. They bayed loudly, happy at what they did best, which was to run their hearts out. From the instant he had gotten his hand on the sled, the whole operation had only taken a few seconds. Scarface's men tried to cut the sled off. The dogs were too fast. They barked gleefully as they outdistanced their pursuers. Once they were in the clear, Austin experimented with the steering. He tried G and haw commands to make the dogs go right and left, and he was glad to see that the team was multilingual. Steering required a tender touch on the wheel, especially on the curves. Turned too sharply and the sled acted like the business end of a bullwhip, although the weight of two people kept all four wheels on the ground. The combined load also kept their speed down. Austin hadn't considered this a problem, figuring that they could still outdistance a running man, especially the burly Scarface and his short-legged cohorts. His confidence drained away when he looked back. Umilik was on the other sled in hot pursuit. Austin steered off the grass onto a paved walkway. The sled picked up speed on the smooth asphalt, but he had to share the walkway, and this was presenting a problem as he wove around obstacles like a slalom racer. He narrowly missed a young couple, then brushed by a man walking a toy poodle that yapped at Austin. He drove a woman on rollerblades up on the turf, and she swore creatively at him. Angry shouts and curses followed the sled as he pushed the dogs to even greater speed. He tried to figure out how long the team would last running at full tilt and decided he didn't have much time. Sled dogs are accustomed to run in the cold and snow, and with their thick fur coats, they would quickly become overheated in the warm evening temperatures. He glanced around to get his bearings. They were moving across the mall, away from the museum, toward the castle and the Smithsonian quad. He looked behind him. Umilik had gained ground, and it would only be a matter of time before he caught up. "Easy," he commanded the dogs and put pressure on the brake to reinforce his command. They slowed. "What are you doing?" Therry said. "Get off." "What?" "Get off and make a run for the lights and people around the Smithsonian. I can't outrun him with you on board. It's me he really wants." Therry reluctantly overcame her natural inclination to argue. Comprehending the danger, she rolled off the sled, then got to her feet and started running. Austin shouted at the dogs to get moving. The team took off again in a neck-snapping start. He made a right-angle turn onto another path. The sled felt lighter and more responsive, and he was moving faster than before. He was glad to see Scarface still chasing him. Therry was safe, but pausing to let her off had given Umilik the chance to gain ground. Austin's eyes were blurred with the sweat running down his forehead. He wiped away the moisture with the sleeve of his tux and glanced over his shoulder. Scarface had cut the distance in half. He dodged another pedestrian and looked ahead. He could see the white spike of the Washington Monument in the distance. There might be armed security guards around the monument, but he would never make it that far. The dogs were becoming weary. He could feel them slow their pace slightly, and the sled was acting like a car running out of gas. He urged the team on with the kissing sound he had heard the drivers use during the race. Cars were moving along the street ahead of him. With luck and timing, he could put the traffic between him and his pursuers. The sled emerged from the mall onto the sidewalk. Austin saw an opening between two moving vehicles and steered for it, hoping to whisk through to the other side of the street. The dogs hesitated, but he urged them on. The paws of the lead dog had left the curb when one of the ubiquitous limos that prowled the streets of Washington came out of nowhere and cut him off. Austin cut the steering wheel hard. The lead dog was way ahead of him and had already changed directions, dashing off to the right with the team and the sled behind him. The sled heeled over at an angle like a boat sailing close to the wind. Austin compensated with his body, and the sled slammed back down on all four wheels and straightened out. The dogs were pulling the sled along the sidewalk. Scarface had cut the angle and was pacing Austin along the sidewalk a few yards away. The two sleds raced along the sidewalk like the chariot racers in Ben-Hur. The dogs swerved around pedestrians. Austin had just about relinquished control, conceding that the dogs could steer the sled far better than he could, and simply concentrated on hanging on. Even at top form, his skills would have been no match for the other driver. The sleds were running side by side, almost close enough to touch. Then Scarface upped the ante and aimed a pistol at Austin from a few feet away. Austin had the feeling that someone had just painted a bullseye on his forehead. But getting a clean shot wouldn't be easy. Scarface held the wheel with his left hand and the pistol in his right. Without the stability of two hands holding on the wheel, the sled wavered from side to side, and Scarface was finding it impossible to keep the pistol barrel leveled. He tried a shot anyhow. The bullet missed Austin and went high. Austin took little comfort from the wild shot. Scarface would keep trying until he emptied his gun. Even if the flying lead missed Austin, someone else could be hurt or killed. Acting more on instinct than intellect, Austin quickly touched his brakes. The Eskimo's sled pulled slightly ahead of him. Borrowing a page from Umilik's book of dirty race tactics, Austin angled his sled to the right. His front wheel hit the rear wheel of the other sled, and Scarface fought to maintain control. The maneuver was risky, but it had the desired effect. With only one sweat-soaked hand gripping the steering wheel, Scarface was unable to stop the rim from spinning. The sled's front wheels jackknifed. The sled fishtailed, then flipped, and Scarface tumbled off, the pistol flying out of his hand and clattering onto the sidewalk. He rolled for several times before coming to a stop. His dog team kept on running, dragging the sled on its side before they figured it was a waste of time. Austin was in no position to celebrate. His team was pulling the sled toward Constitution Avenue. He yelled a command to stop and jammed his foot down on the brakes, but it was no use. The dogs had been spooked by the gunshot and unnerved by Austin's erratic driving, and he realized he was simply along for the ride. They plunged into the busy boulevard without looking. The sled flew off the curb, became airborne, and slammed down on all four wheels. Austin's teeth rattled in his skull. There was a banshee screech as an SUV as big as a house slammed on its brakes, its big chrome grille only inches away. Austin caught a glimpse of the horrified face behind the wheel, the driver's eyes popping out of his head as he watched a man in a tux drive a sled team across Washington's busiest boulevard. The best Austin could do was to hang on and try to keep the sled upright. His ears were filled with the squeal of brakes, and then he heard a thud as someone rear-ended another car. There were several more thuds as the chain reaction continued. The air reeked of the smell of burnt rubber. Then he was safely across the avenue and the dogs were scrambling onto the opposite sidewalk. The sled was moving slow enough for him to jump off before it hit the curb. The dogs were exhausted from running in the unaccustomed heat and had no desire to keep moving. They simply plopped down where they were, their sides heaving and their tongues dripping like faucets. Austin looked back across the trail of chaos he had left on Constitution Avenue. Traffic on his side had come to a stop, and angry people were getting out of their cars to trade registration and license numbers. Scarface stood on the opposite curb, blood streaming down his face. He pulled his knife from his belt. Holding it close to his chest, he stepped off the curb, only to pause at the sound of sirens. Then one of the kennel trucks Austin had seen near the racecourse screeched to a stop, hiding the Eskimo from view for a few seconds. When it took off a second later, the man had vanished. Austin went over to the panting dogs and patted each one on the head. "We'll have to do this again, but not too soon," he said. He brushed the knees and elbows of his tuxedo, but he knew he must look as if he were coming off a weekend binge. Shrugging in resignation, he walked back to the museum. There he was standing on the Constitution Avenue side of the four-story granite edifice. The expression of anxiety on her face disappeared when she saw Austin trudging toward her, and she ran over to throw her arms around him. "Thank goodness you're all right," she said, hugging him in a tight embrace. "What happened to that awful man?" "He got thrown for a loop by the Washington traffic and called it a night. Sorry I had to kick you off back there." "That's all right. I've been dumped by guys before, although this is the first time it's been off a moving dog sled." Therese said that after she had been unceremoniously kicked off the sled, she had found a police cruiser parked near the castle. She'd told the police that her friend was in danger of being murdered on the mall, and though the police had looked at her as if she were crazy, they did go to investigate. She had come back to the museum to look for Ben, but there'd been no sign of him. She was trying to decide what to do next when she heard the sirens, walked onto the boulevard, and saw Austin plodding down the avenue. They shared a cab back to their cars and parted with a lingering kiss and the promise to get in touch the next day. A turquoise Numa vehicle was in his driveway when Austin got home, and the front door was unlocked. He walked into the house and heard the Dave Brubeck Quartet playing Take Five on the stereo. Sitting in Austin's favorite black leather chair with a drink in his hand was Rudy Gunn, second in command at Numa. Gunn was a wiry little man, slim with narrow shoulders and matching hips. He was a master of logistics, a graduate of Annapolis, and a former commander in the Navy. "Hope you don't mind my breaking into your house," Gunn said. "Not at all. That's why I gave you the lock code." Gunn pointed to the glass. "You're getting a little low on your Highland malt scotch whiskey," he said, his lips turning up in his typical mischievous grin. "I'll talk to the butler about it." Austin recognized the book that Gunn was holding. "Didn't know you liked Nietzsche." "I found it on the coffee table. Pretty heavy stuff." "It might be heavier than you think," Austin said, going over to the bar to mix himself a dark and stormy. Gunn put the book aside and picked up a bound folder from a side table. "Thanks for getting your report to me. I found it far more interesting than Mr. Nietzsche's writings." "Thought you might," Austin said, settling into a sofa with his drink. Gunn pushed his thick, horn-rimmed glasses up onto his thinning hair and leafed through the folder. "At times like this, I realize what a boring life I lead," he said with a shake of his head. "You've really missed your calling. You should be writing scripts for video games." Austin took a big gulp of his drink, savoring the deep flavor of the dark rum and the tingle of the Jamaican ginger beer. "Nah, this stuff's too far-fetched." "I beg to differ, old pal. What's far-fetched about a mysterious corporation that sinks ships by remote control? A long-lost cave with fantastic wall art in the Faroe Islands. A creature out of Jaws that knocks you on your ass." He started to chuckle uncontrollably. "Now that's something I would have liked to have witnessed." "There's no such thing as respect anymore," Austin lamented. Gunn got his composure back and he turned a few more pages. The list goes on and on. Murderous Eskimo thugs who hunt humans instead of seals. Oh, yes. A female attorney with a radical environmental group. He looked up from his reading. She has long, slim legs, I suppose. Austin thought about Therese's figure. About average in length, I'd say, but quite shapely. Can't have everything, I suppose. Gunn put the folder on his lap and gave Austin the once-over, taking in his scuffed shoes, crooked bow tie, and the hole in the knee of the tuxedo. Did the bouncer throw you out of the museum reception? You look a little, rumpled? The reception was fine, but I learned that Washington is going to the dogs. Hope that tux wasn't rented, Gunn said. Worse, Austin replied. I own it. Maybe Numa will buy me a new one. I'll take it up with Admiral Sandecker, Gunn said. Austin refreshed their drinks, then laid out the story of the meeting with Marcus Ryan and the evening's events. After absorbing the account without comment, Gunn tapped the report on his lap. Any thoughts on how your dog sled adventure fits in with this wild tale? Lots of thoughts, but nothing coherent. I'll sum up what I know in a single sentence. The people who run Oceanus deal ruthlessly with anyone who gets in their way. That would be my conclusion, too, based on what you've said. Gunn paused for a moment, brow furrowed. He had the capacity to think as coldly and clearly as a computer. He processed the mountain of information, separating the wheat from the chaff. After a few moments, he said, "What about this Basque character, Aguirre's?" Interesting fellow. He's the wild card in this poker game. I talked to a friend at the CIA. Aguirre's may or may not be allied with Basque separatists. Perlmutter is looking into the family background for me. All I know for now is that he's either a Basque terrorist or an amateur archaeologist. Take your pick. Maybe he could bird dog this thing for us. Too bad you can't get in touch with him. Austin set his drink down, pulled his wallet from his pocket, and extracted the card Aguirre's had given him as he was leaving the Basque's yacht. He handed the card to Gunn, who saw the phone number on the back. "Why not?" he said, and handed the card back. Austin picked up a phone and punched out the number. He was tired from the night's exertions, and his expectations were low. So he was startled when he heard the familiar basso voice on the line. "What a pleasant surprise, Mr. Austin. I had the feeling we'd be talking again. Hope I'm not interrupting anything important." "Not at all." "Are you still in the Faroes?"
"I am in Washington on business."
"Washington?"
"Yes, the fishing in the Faroes didn't live up to its reputation."
"What can I do for you, Mr. Austin?"
"I called to thank you for pulling me out of some difficulties in Copenhagen."
Aguirre has made no attempt to deny that his men had chased away the club-yielding thugs who'd attacked Austin and Therry Weld. He simply laughed and said,
"You have a way of getting yourself in difficult situations, my friend."
"Most of my troubles have to do with a company called Oceanus. I was hoping we might chat about that subject again. Maybe you could bring me up to date on your archaeological investigation as well."
"I'd like that very much," Aguirre said. "I have meetings in the morning, but tomorrow afternoon would be convenient."
They agreed on a time, and Austin jotted down the directions Aguirre gave him for an address in Washington. He hung up and started to fill Gunn in on the short conversation when the phone rang. It was Zavala, who had returned from Europe. Joe had fixed the problems with the sea lamprey, then had jumped ship when the Beebe had been invited by the Danish vessel Thor to join in a Faroe Islands research project.
"Just wanted to let you know I'm home. I've hugged my Corvette, and I'm about to head out for a nightcap with a beautiful young lady, Zavala said. Anything new since I last saw you? The usual stuff. Tonight, a crazy Eskimo on a dog sled chased me through the mall with murder in his heart. Other than that, things are quiet. There was silence at the other end of the line. Then Zavala said, You're not kidding, are you? Nope. Rudy's here. Drop by my place and you'll get the whole sordid story. Zavala lived in a small building in Arlington, Virginia that had once housed a district library. Guess I'm canceling that date. Be by in a few minutes, he said. One more thing. Still got that bottle of tequila we were going to break into back in the Faroes? Sure. It's in my duffel bag. I think you better bring it with you.